Set down your sleepy water and your Mr. Whistle. Take off that raincoat and grab a cold beer. It's time to have a real talk about pediatric dentistry. You're listening to Bruise and Tiny Teeth, the unfiltered pediatric dentistry podcast.
Close in the last 2 years. We'll close in, I think, late April. Thanks to you.
That's crazy. Well, and I appreciate that, but I also was kind of interested and a bit surprised because I know my audience tends to be a lot of residents, a lot of young pediatric dentists, but I know a certain percentage of them that I get feedback from tends to be, mid-career and late-career dentists. So it's kind of nice to do these episodes for those guys. And to your point, I know in a lot of your articles you talk about there's a lot of guys and gals that are in their 30s that are starting to make the move to take some chips off the table. And it's not just like a 50, 60-year-old game anymore. So it's nice you guys picked up some business from me and made a big deal off of our last episode. But all that being said, Chip, we're live and off in recording. So I appreciate you coming on and spending a little time kind of keeping me up to speed with what's going on in the DSO and private equity world and all that. So I appreciate you coming back on the podcast.
No, thanks for having me.
Yeah. So I wanted to start this off by saying, you and I had a conversation probably about a year and a half, 2 years ago. And for any listener that's tuning in and is maybe interested in this type of conversation, I encourage you to go back and check that one out, because in that episode, we talked about some of the easy stuff about maybe, what's the dental trifecta and what's the difference between a DSO and an IDSO and where's this money coming from? We talked about a lot of the easy stuff. And so I made a point today with the questions I wrote down to not give you any softballs today here, Chip. So I went through some articles and I kind of came up with some, maybe outside the box questions, maybe some devil's advocate points, just trying to stimulate some conversation and make some educational points so that I can kind of ask you some things that you're not talking about over and over and over again all day. If that's cool with you, I'm going to try to come up with some tougher ones.
Please do.
So let's, can you give me a quick recap for those that are not familiar with LPS and kind of what you do? Can you give kind of the 60 second summary? I know your business has grown. You guys, I think, did $1 billion in sales or whatever it was, but give us kind of an up to speed look at what your business is and kind of the industry it's involved in.
Absolutely. Thank you. Thanks again for having me. Large Practice Sales is the largest advisor to dentists in the country with larger practices. Our average practice is going to have a minimum of $2 million in collections. In pedo, sometimes a little less, because pedo practices are the most valuable practice types of all in the industry today. And we have completed $1 billion of what we call invisible DSO partnerships for our clients over the last 24 months. And what's interesting about that is $150 million of those partnerships were for doctors under 40. So there's been a dramatic shift to doctors eager to partner with an invisible DSO versus a traditional DSO by selling anywhere between 51 and 80% of their practice for cash up front and retaining ownership and continuing to lead their practice as owners with their brand, team, strategy, and full autonomy for years or decades. And frankly, the younger the doctor is today, the more valuable they are.
Perfect. That was a great summary. So I'm sure this is a question that's the big one you've been getting asked ever since we talked, because our macroeconomic environment has changed a lot. The Federal Reserve is trying to combat all this inflation, raising interest rates. And I have to imagine that's kind of affected the access to capital and the money that the backing is coming from for these DSOs. So that was kind of my first thing I wanted to talk about was, is access to capital an issue, and or have we seen some liquidity issues or access to capital been an issue with some of these DSOs? Have we seen the market soften a little bit, just knowing that interest rates rising can kind of eat into free cash flows a little bit? What does access to capital look like? Are they more restrictive now on the type of practices they're buying, or is there still a lot of money out there that they're trying to purchase dental offices with?
So great question. And the answer is that yes, interest rates have impacted multiple invisible DSOs across the country. And keep in mind, there are about 1,000 of them out there. Now, we consider 900 of them to be on our blacklist, meaning they are not allowed to bid on our clients. But what's happened is you've had a number of groups that have been impacted by higher rates. So it has reduced their desire or opportunity to partner with great practices. But interestingly, in 23, we set records for values of practices of all types, including pediatric, And more interestingly, we had multiple bidders, more bidders in 23 than we had in 22. So you would think that with higher interest rates squeezing them, some of them out of the partnering process, that we would have had fewer bidders. Well, the reality is our average pediatric client last year had at least 8 qualified bidders. And the reason for that is the amount of new capital that has been poured into the invisible DSOs, not the DSOs, but the invisible DSOs. We estimate in 22 and 23, there was about $10 billion invested in the invisible DSOs. And in 24, year to date, and we're not even through the end of the first quarter yet, there's been over $3.3 billion invested in invisible DSOs. So you have fresh capital with eager bidders. Several of them are new invisible DSOs and others are more mature invisible DSOs that have been recapitalized with that $3.3 billion. So what you have are you have groups with new capital that have replaced those that have been harmed by the interest rates. So it's been an interesting dynamic, but today any great pediatric practice is going to achieve a record value and is going to have 6, 8, 10, 12. We had one pedo practice last year with 13 bidders.
Wow. Well, it sounds like this environment, from the way you described it, is just kind of weeding out the invisible DSOs and the organizations that were not positioned well or not, you know, kind of over leveraged or things. And it's kind of an only the strong survive situation and still getting some strong offers. But has the source of this funding, source of this money changed from like floating balloon payment, you know, balloon interest rates and floating variable interest rate debt to more like venture capital, private equity, or is there any change in the source of the money at this point?
Well, let's talk about the traditional financiers of the invisible DSO game, which has been going on for 35 years now. So traditionally, private equity was considered the primary backer of invisible DSOs, and certainly they have been the majority. But the reality is there have been other investor types participating in the invisible DSO consolidation game. And as an example, over the last 3 years, we've partnered over $300 million of our clients with non-private equity-backed invisible DSOs. So in the last 2 years, you've had sovereign wealth funds get into the invisible DSO game. Sovereign wealth funds have a lot of money. In this particular case, the country of Abu Dhabi Sovereign Wealth Fund, which is the third largest in the world after China and Norway, which is pretty interesting because it's a country of 2.5 million people. They invested $1 billion in an invisible DSO last year. And BlackRock, which is the world's largest traditional money manager with $10 trillion under management in the last 14 months, has invested in 2 invisible DSOs, both of them specialty, one of them a dental trifecta invisible DSO. So the sources of the money, the size of the money, and the eagerness of these investors has definitely grown and changed.
Okay, good answer. So let's go back when we were talking about kind of the only strong survive, and we've seen some DSOs wind up on your blacklist or maybe ones that aren't well capitalized and that sort of thing. It got me thinking, I don't really know. And I wanted to ask you what happens if you, obviously you try to avoid this, but let's say I want to sell my practice and we get a really competitive bidder, maybe an up and coming invisible DSO, and we sell and I get my cash up front, but that retained equity, I haven't, you know, it seems like, I don't know if there's non-disclosure things, but I haven't really talked to a person that's had that situation, but I do know it happens where you have an issue with the retained equity when the parent company folds. And I just was curious, like what happens when that happens? Is there a clause that allows you as the seller to regain or have the option to repurchase, or, you know, the part of the equity you sold, or does that debt get bundled and typically get bought up by a different DSO? That's just something people don't talk about. But if I feel like if you're going to sell your practice, you maybe need to be prepared for worst case scenario if in fact that does happen.
Well, you know, the good news is I can say, knock on wood, that in our, I don't know, $4 billion of transactions in the last 6 years, we've never yet partnered a doctor with one that has failed. And the reality is that very few of these groups actually fail, which is why you've had billions and billions of dollars consistently invested in this space. So the answer is, if you choose wisely, that's a very low risk problem. Certainly, there are plenty of them that will not achieve the kinds of equity gains that they're promising at the moment. And I think that's a bigger risk. But I think there will be a small fraction of dentists that will actually lose any equity in any of the invisible DSOs if they choose wisely. Now, there will be plenty of them, given all the new capital, that are going to have problems.
What are some of the predictive factors that you can kind of look at to make sure that doesn't happen? I know in some of your past publications, you've talked about different things you look at, but do you guys have access or what are some of the factors in terms of like management? Are you able to look at the financials of some of these bidders or is it a relationship thing? Like, how do you guys vet out the good, you know, companies to work with versus the ones that are not positioned well?
Great question. And the answer is the first thing you want to look at is who are the investors? And we like to find invisible DSOs that are backed by groups which have experience in multi-site healthcare consolidation and preferably experience in dental consolidation. You know, there are some investors out there who have created and monetized 7 or 8 invisible DSOs over the last 10 years. There's one in particular that's returned over $3 billion to their doctors and investors. They know what they're doing. So the first thing you have to look at when selecting an invisible DSO is who's the money. Then you certainly want to look at the invisible DSO's financials and understand those in detail, particularly their capital structure. In other words, the equity that the doctor is getting, how is that structured and what is it really? And what's his opportunity to exit that? And then you want to look at management. Management is critical. Some of these groups that are on our blacklist today were not on our blacklist 6 months ago, but they have entirely new management teams. And so before we would allow them to bid on our clients, we want to understand what that new management team is going to do in the future. So we put them on hold and we're going to watch and see what the new management does and then make a decision as to whether they are qualified to bid on our clients. And then you work down the list and you want to look at groups that are actively partnering with new practices, because if you're not growing, you're not creating equity value. And that's important. And then one of the great tests is looking at the practices that they've partnered with. The great invisible DSOs will only partner with great doctors. So when we see invisible DSOs that have partnered with doctors that we have declined to represent for whatever reason, that usually means that they are going to be on our blacklist.
Gotcha. Okay. So tied into that, a question I have or a concern people might have is obviously these companies are very different than publicly traded companies regulated by the SEC that have open financials that you can look at. So do you guys have access? You know, I'm trying to think of the things you can see as far as like, okay, this DSO we've worked with before, I know their leadership because you have those personal connections, but it's not like there's a publicly accessible look into their financials unless maybe you've done a deal with them. So my question is, how do you get to look at like, you know, the actual finances behind these businesses buying practices?
Excellent question. And the answer is we do as much due diligence on the prospective bidders as they will do on the clients that they acquire. So absolutely, we're looking at all of their financials to make sure they're qualified to be bidders and therefore ultimately potential partners with our clients. No, we're looking at the financials. Forget whether they're publicly available or not. If they won't provide them to us, then they are not a qualified bidder.
Okay, that makes sense. So kind of part of the deal, they kind of got to open up and show you what they're working with and show you practices in their portfolio and everything else like that. So I guess that makes
sense. Absolutely. And the current performance of the practices in their portfolio, that's very important, especially in orthodontics today. You know, we had a K-start drop in 22 of 8% and a K-start drop in 23 of 6% in ortho. And so of the 14 ortho-only invisible DSOs, some of them are very crippled at the moment because not only are they not growing, they're not making their debt service payments. So you got to be careful. Whereas the trifecta groups who are pedo, ortho, oral surgery have not had the same issues.
Yeah. Yeah. I imagine this is, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I have to think this is a pretty small world as well, where, you know, Jim, who's the head of this DSO, and Bob, who's the head of this IDSO. And so you kind of know, okay, these guys are shysters and this guy does good work. I have to imagine you guys probably all know and work with each other a fair amount, which probably helps in the process.
We do. We absolutely learn because, you know, with every one of our clients, ultimately, we're going to get down to 3 finalist bidders who are going to join us for 3 consecutive dinners with our clients. And so it's us, our clients, and typically, because of the size of the deals we do, it's the CEOs of the invisible DSO that are joining us for dinner. So we get to know all of them, some of them on a very personal level.
Mm-hmm. It's good to know. Okay, shifting gears just a little bit, another question I came up with I wanted to talk about was calculating EBITDA. This is obviously not a beginner question. People that are listening that are dental students don't know what EBITDA is, are going to have to do a little homework behind that. But I had a question when it came to calculating EBITDA. And my question is, the more that I understand and learn about calculating EBITDA in your practice, the more I realize and understand why it's not a generally accepted accounting principle, non-GAAP principle, just because there's some variability in how you come up with that number. So where does that number get calculated? Do you guys independently, when you go out to bid, I come to you with my practice and I want to know what it's worth and how much I can get for it. Does your company, do I give you my financials and you guys calculate EBITDA for me on my end? And then the bidding companies will independently do their own, or do you pitch my EBITDA to them and see if they agree? Or is there a way to kind of get multiple opinions and spot check, hey, is this actual multiple of EBITDA correct, since that number is so important for getting a big bid?
Great question. So the answer is ultimately the EBITDA upon which the final closing is based on a number that is created in a process called the quality of earnings test. The quality of earnings test is a fancy way of saying an audit that's done by the buyer's independent advisor on the practice. So our goal when we initially talk to a doctor is to calculate the EBITDA just as the buyer or the invisible DSO will ultimately in that quality of earnings process. So yes, absolutely. I've got a team of a dozen people that spend their days calculating EBITDA, knowing which invisible DSO is going to apply different formulas to calculating EBITDA. Good example, we had an oral surgery practice last year. It had 18 qualified bidders. This was a big practice in Florida, great place to be. And the range in the calculation of the EBITDA by the buyers, not ours, but by the buyers, there was a $1.2 million differential in the EBITDA as calculated by the buyers. So our job is to calculate the most rational EBITDA that we can, the highest one, taking into account the EBITDA that we present to each buyer is going to be different. And you say, why? Well, for example, let's say you have an implant practice and that implant practice is doing 1,000 implants a year, and you're paying $260 for that implant from Straumann. Well, your new partner is probably paying $110 for that exact same implant. So that $150 per implant differential across 1,000 implants is a $150,000 swing in EBITDA. And some of the bidders will give the doctor credit for the differential between their cost of supplies and the new partner's cost of supplies. So you can have a dramatic increase in EBITDA if you have the right bidder who calculates EBITDA the right way. So different bidders use different formulas, and it's not just in supplies costs, it's in payer reimbursement rates. We did a transaction recently on the East Coast. Practice had $4 million in collections. The new bidder was getting reimbursed at 20% higher rates than our client who was doing $4 million in collections. So that bidder could create an instant increase in EBITDA of $800,000. Now, this is a 10 times EBITDA deal. So it was an $8 million bump in the purchase price because we knew how a particular bidder was getting reimbursed from the payers. And we knew that they would give our client credit for that that increase. So calculating EBITDA is really in theory very simple. You take all of your revenues, you subtract all of your costs, you subtract a number for the doctor's compensation. You've got to pay the doctor to do the work. And at the end, there's a bottom line. But the reality is there are a lot of variables that go into calculating that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, I was trying to think of a follow-up question, and I would have thought I was going to ask, where do you find big discrepancies and differences? I would have thought it might have been arguments over how much do you pay the doctor, but you brought up some good ones like fee schedules. And I guess I didn't realize that. Maybe is it just like economies of scale thing that DSOs are, they have manpower to work with insurance companies like Delta and all the big carriers where they can negotiate higher fee schedules? Do they have that power? How are they able to get higher fee schedules?
Leverage. So for instance, in the case of this one who's getting reimbursed at 20% higher rates than my client, who's not a small practice, he had leverage, he's $4 million in collections. Well, his new partner has 32 other GP practices in the same state. And it's a relatively small state and there are relatively few payers. And so the invisible DSO is able to go to the payers and go, look, we're covering you across 32 offices. We've just acquired this one. And if we don't get the kind of reimbursement rates that are required for us to provide great patient care, then we're not going to be able to provide coverage to any of your assureds. So it's a leverage thing. The bigger ones are getting reimbursed at higher rates than the little ones, and they're all getting reimbursed at higher rates than the independent dentists. Now, that's not true across the country. It's not true in every community. It's not true for every specialty, but it is a growing trend as these groups get bigger.
Okay. Yeah, that's helpful. That's helpful to know. Maybe we could shift gears a little bit too. We haven't really focused specifically on pediatric dentistry. And I know you've mentioned before in previous podcasts that peds is kind of the bedrock in a lot of DSOs like pediatric offices, because they can use that as a home base and branch and scale off of that. So before I get into the weeds, has there been any changes or any trends you're seeing with pediatric dentistry the last year or two? What EBITDA multiples are you seeing? What are some of the, are there a handful, you know, I don't know if you can tell me some of the top three to five, like big DSOs that are kind of the competitive big gorillas in the room that are buying them up, or if it's really spread amongst a lot of smaller ones. I just was kind of hoping to get a pedo specific update here.
Absolutely. Now, pediatric dentists continue to be the most valuable practice types in the dental jungle, because you're the gateway to all dentistry. And we have, we helped create the first of the big dental trifectas, which grew from my idea in the summer of 19 to over 200 practices by the end of the summer 22. That group recapitalized at a new record value of 20 times EBITDA. Previous to that, the biggest record was a 17 times EBITDA for a predominantly GP practice in the Southwest that was actually bought by Blackstone. So in this particular trifecta, what drove its 20 times EBITDA exit value was the fact that they were able to create organic growth, because the only practices that they partnered with were pedos, orthos, and oral surgeons. So when they went into a community and acquired an ortho and then added a pedo and an oral surgeon, everybody's referring to each other. So they created something that's extraordinarily valuable in an exit or value creation event for an invisible DSO, which is organic growth. So in one city, for instance, we partnered a single invisible DSO, a dental trifecta invisible DSO, with 48 offices over a 9-month period of time. 23 of them, 24 of them were pedo. The other 24 were nearby referral distance orthos and oral surgeons. And we looked at that a year after completing that, and they had over double digit, over 20% average growth rate across all 48 offices. And that's why they achieved a 20 times EBITDA recapitalization in less than 36 months from partnering with their first practice. So what happened then? Well, the money tends to be like lemmings. And so they saw the success of the dental trifecta, not only in its exit multiple, but the fact that it was able to create organic growth without spending a whole lot of marketing dollars. And so there are now a dozen more dental trifecta focused invisible DSOs eager to partner only with pedo, ortho, and oral surgery in the same communities. And many of those have new capital that is financing their growth, and that new capital is not impacted by high interest rates. And so you have these groups bidding against each other for great pedo practices. The bigger they are, the more valuable they are. So a small pedo practice might today be worth 8 times EBITDA, whereas 2 years ago, it was worth 6.25 or 6.5. And we just completed a transaction for a large pedo practice at 11 times EBITDA. So there's your range for value, and it's a function of size, growth rate, age of doctor, and geography.
What in your mind, having done quite a few of these transactions, do you kind of categorize a small pediatric office versus a large? Because we, you know, even though it sounds cool to talk about these really big pediatric offices, the reality is pedos, even though it's becoming more group practice, there's a lot of us that are solo docs, you know, or like small partnerships. But what in your mind, maybe an EBITDA or a collection standpoint, do you go from saying, okay, this is a smaller office, but still, you know, a good candidate for maybe selling off some equity, versus this is when we get into the larger range? What ranges are you seeing?
You know, $1.5 million in collections is kind of where a pediatric practice today is getting up to the EBITDA numbers that will command the high values from the invisible DSOs.
Okay. So that leads me into my next question. I wanted you to maybe describe for me the perfect if we're going to talk single location, whether it be a single doctor, multiple, you know, multi-practice or a multi-doctor practice, obviously, if you're less than a million in collections, you got a 60% overhead, might be better positioned for just a traditional private, you know, sell to an upcoming resident, you know, in that sort of traditional sense. But once you get over that 1 million point, 1.5 million, and you get lower overhead, a DSO sale makes sense just because younger grads have the debt loads and have a harder time, you know, getting funding to buy these bigger practices. But that being said, I wanted to see if you could outline, if you could take your hands and mold a perfect solo pediatric dental practice, what would it look like? You know, what would it look like? Where would it be located? What kind of numbers would you like to see? Kind of overhead. I'm trying to think if somebody wants to put themselves in that position, or if you have a younger dentist who knows they don't want to practice forever and just wants to get in and get out and build this practice in a hurry. What in your mind is an ideal small pediatric practice, single location look like?
Well, you can't count by location because our biggest deal last year was a $43 million transaction for a single office practice.
Wow.
Not a single doctor, but a single office practice. And having multiple offices can be a plus if you control the overhead, but it can also be a big hit to EBITDA if you have limited revenues across multiple offices. So you got to be careful in going to the multiple offices and make sure you can build that office up to the size where it's profitable. And so, you know, if I were going to mold a single doctor, no associate practice, the first thing I would do is I would say, get an associate. And you say, why would you do that? Well, in pedo, you have no shortage of demand, and a two-doctor practice is more valuable than a one-doctor practice most of the time. Why? Because you eliminate risk. If one of the two doctors gets hit by a bus, you still have one. In a one-doctor practice, if the doctor gets hit by a bus, you have nothing. So I urge any doctors that you need to be looking down the associate train if you want to achieve maximum values. So let's create our theoretical two-doctor pediatric practice is going to do $3 million in collections, and they're going to have an EBITDA of 20 to 25% of that number after paying the doctors, so $600,000 to $750,000. And if it's young doctors, let's say they're under 50 and they're growing and they're in a growth state, one where population is increasing, not declining. So let's say they're in Florida, not Illinois, or not New York, or not California. You know, that practice with reasonably young doctors is going to get close to getting 10 times EBITDA today.
Wow. Wow. And you said 10 times EBITDA, but important for listeners to understand that 10 times. So let's say you've got a $600,000 in EBITDA in earnings, and you get a 10 times multiple. That $6 million, just having you clarify, doesn't mean you get a check for $6 million. It means you come up and negotiate, and that's where the devil's in the details, but some degree in cash and some degree in retained equity and ownership of that parent company that can grow in the future. Correct.
Yeah, but let's clarify that. So the doctors will have the option to get anywhere between 51 and 80% of the value of their practice in cash up front, with it predominantly being long-term capital gains tax treatment, so 20% federal. The equity that they retain does not have to be in the parent company. You can retain equity in an invisible DSO partnership in one of three ways. Number one, you can retain ownership directly in your practice, so you are betting on the success of your practice. Option two is to retain ownership in the parent company, and option three is to retain ownership in both. So you're now in the parent company equity, you still have equity at the practice level. And pretty much any of our pediatric clients will have all three of those options to choose from. And there are different reasons why you choose different structures, and it's doctor driven.
Okay. So besides, I like you brought up location, be in a state that at least has some growth, maybe a tax friendlier state, you know, get your EBITDA up, possibly get an associate. You know, does it help to, if I'm been, you know, maybe been in the practice for 15 years and does somebody come out and look at your equipment and get a feel for the office and look at it in person and say, man, this place looks rough? Or is it worth it to invest some money to clean the place up, do some minor renovations? Or is there anything else specific that you can do now to kind of make yourself more attractive for a buyout down the road?
But you've got to look at what it is. You do not have to be on the bleeding edge of technology, number one. I think ultimately AI is going to become a standard of care. In the near future, I think doctors need to understand the impact of that on their business because it's coming, particularly in diagnostics. Secondarily, you don't have to be on the bleeding edge. You need to be this century from a technology standpoint. As far as offices go, the most important thing in an office is that it is clean and neat. I see too many practices that are not as clean as they should be. They have light bulbs that are out. They have stains on their ceiling tiles in their drop ceilings. Their labs are a mess, and there's no reason for that. I haven't seen a practice that with $10,000 worth of lipstick could not look much better. Paint is a really cheap thing to do. And lighting, LED lighting is really magical. And if you don't have LED lighting in your practice, it's a cheap upgrade. And I recommend doing it. Before we start marketing our clients, we're going to take a look at every square inch of that office. And we're going to give suggestions. Hey, that door handle on the closet behind you is broken. I think you ought to think about fixing that. And for nominal amounts of money, you can improve the physical appearance of the practice. So ultimately, when you get down to those three finalist bidders and they're going to come do an after-hours tour, you want your practice to look good. It's not big money, though. It's not, oh, I got to spend $100,000 for a new scanner, or I've got to spend whatever. Don't have to do that. You know, you have 20-year-old chairs. That's not the end of the world. Chairs haven't changed that much in 20 years. They need to look good. They need to not have tears in the upholstery. But it's important where you spend the money when dressing up a practice to prepare for a partnership.
Gotcha. Yeah, it sounds like staging a house or something if you're going to stage a house. Yeah, same concept. So before I move on to kind of the last subject, I want to go back. You said a $43 million single doc, obviously multiple doctors within that practice. Can you tell me about what kind of deal that was? Like, tell me more about that practice, because obviously that's a crazy amount of money. But what do you have to do to get to a buyout of that scale?
Well, that one was really unique. It was a 29,000 square foot practice with a 39-year-old single owner doctor that he had built from scratch. Absolutely phenomenal practice. It was a multi-specialty practice. And the thing that made them most valuable was, one, he was what we call a doctor with a personality and a plan. He already had proven he knew how to grow, and his invisible DSO partner really wanted him as a partner because they wanted to replicate his success. He knew what to do. He was passionate. He was a leader. And so he became the platform for a new invisible DSO. The investor has done it seven times before. They have started and built seven other very successful invisible DSOs. So we knew the right place for him at the right moment in time. And so we actually got him over 14 times EBITDA.
Wow. So it sounds like he just had one big, large building, probably owned the real estate. And then he had a bunch of associates, brought in an oral surgeon, brought in ortho, kind of just really scale it to a big central mecca there.
Correct. And it was in a small town in the Midwest.
Love it. Yeah, that's always cool. I'm a Midwest guy, so you know that. So that makes me happy. You don't have to be in Florida or Texas.
You do not. You just have to be growing with a personality and a plan. Those are three key elements.
Cool. Okay. And then, I forgot. I didn't get a follow-up to this question. You may not be able to, for the sake of to be able to tell me, but are there a handful of big names like MB2 and D4C? Are there a couple big names that you tend to buy up a lot of these offices? Or is it fairly well spread out amongst, a variety of DSOs in different shapes and sizes?
No, it's a variety of DSOs in various shapes and sizes. You know, MB2 is a great group. We sold them one of their first practices almost 7 years ago, and we've partnered dozens of our clients with them. They're never the high bidder, and you have to buy into their culture and understand that ultimately part of the equity you receive in an MB2 deal can become stranded, meaning there's no way out of it ever. And there are different ways to offset that, and there are different ways to negotiate that. And we've got a lot of happy MB2 clients. And in the interest of full disclosure, I won't even go there. MB2 is a great group. D4C, on the other hand, is a legacy group, pedo ortho only, now trying to add oral surgery. I would be very careful there.
Okay.
In the interest of full disclosure, we have never partnered a practice with D4C.
That's good to know. I'm from Iowa, and it seems like every practice in Iowa that I knew got offers, and they really moved in hard into Iowa for various reasons. So a lot of my colleagues and friends were getting offers from them. So I know they played a big role in Iowa as well.
Well, the thing is, when these, and all of them do this, it's not unique to MB2 or D4C or any of them, is they're going to go directly to the doctors. Because when they can do a deal with a doctor directly, they're going to buy it cheaper. It's just logical. If you have one bidder for your asset, you're not going to get the highest value than if you go through our process and you've got 10 bidders. So I can promise you, we have a love-hate relationship with our friends at MB2, because any doctor that we talk to, they've already gone to directly. They've given the doctor an offer. And I say, look, with MB2, it's real easy. Bring me your offer. And if I can't beat it net of my fee, then we'll close the transaction for you for free. And closing these transactions is hard. So we've never lost that bet. We are always able to create bidding contests for our clients, which either will cause MB2 to drive their offers up, or other groups will outbid them. So the doctors who try and do these transactions themselves are oftentimes leaving millions of dollars on the table.
Okay. That was a good answer. And I appreciate being kind of transparent with that. So one or two last final topics. Do you find, again, I talk to a lot of pediatric dentists off camera, off air, after podcasts, private messaging, but not a lot of people can/want to talk about their experiences with either trying to sell or successfully selling to a DSO. You have some that are very happy and some that maybe things went south. But a lot of times they just are kind of hesitant to talk about it for legality's sake. So my question was, but do you sometimes have dentists approach you that are interested in selling? You go through the bidding process, you get to the final stages, maybe you have three bidders, and then things like, when do deals fall apart? You know, do these deals fall apart in the late stages, for like in the contract stage, where they want this doctor, like maybe they look at your last year's numbers and say, we don't like this, or maybe you're wanting to take some time off and they balk at it and then knock a bunch of EBIT off. What do you find that these deals will fall up, not will, but fall apart last minute? And if so, what are the late stage issues that get dentists into trouble that make these deals not happen?
You know, the good news is deals generally don't happen, and there are deals that fall apart. But it's generally the doctor changing his mind. An associate is very disgruntled about the thought of the owner doctor becoming a part of a DSO. That's usually because the associate hasn't been educated on why it's good for him or her. But yeah, things do fall apart, but it's generally driven by the doctor. We're dealing with the qualified and visible DSOs that aren't going to come back and play games. They're not going to try and backtrade their deals. However, one of the other things that drives deals to come apart is when a doctor goes through our process, which is going to take 6 to 7 months. And during the process, they take their foot off the gas and their revenues go down. And when your revenues go down, your EBITDA goes down. And by definition, your value goes down. So we've had that happen. So as long as a doctor is continuing to grow through the transaction, the initial estimate of value that I'm going to give a doctor without cost or obligation, our free valuation, is going to go up. So in 22, I haven't calculated it for 23 yet, but in 22, our deals closed at an average of 22% higher than what I originally suggested would be the value the doctor could achieve. But transactions very rarely blow up because of the buyer, because the buyers know, hey, these are the terms. I know if I try and crawfish on this deal, LPS will never show me another deal. And so, yeah, there is backtrading that goes on between the DSOs when they're buying a doctor directly. But with us, they kind of know not to do that. And our goal in these transactions is to make sure that our clients fully understand what they're getting into and what life is going to look like a year later or 2 years later. And the way we do that is, as we get down to the finalists, after the three finalist dinners, we're going to put our client on the phone with other doctors who have joined the invisible DSOs that he's considering as the one or the finalist. And he's going to have a conversation doc to doc, nobody else on the phone, and with multiple doctors, and say, okay, tell me what changed, what didn't change. Are you glad you did it? Would you do it again? Most importantly, did they do what they said they would do? And so, you know, part of this is about education. So yes, deals fall apart, but it's rarely falling apart because, at least in our world, of the buyer changing terms or And we had one almost fall apart last week because one of the doctors was doing pro bono work, and the invisible DSO's malpractice policy would not cover him doing pro bono work outside of the practice, not physically in the practice. And so this was a $27 million transaction for a 45-year-old doctor who was going to blow it up over $5,000 worth of malpractice per year. So funny things happen.
Yeah, I could imagine. So you had mentioned if you've got a young dentist listening who's an early practice owner and isn't ready to sell or even really thinking about it, but just maybe, I don't want to say for fun because not wasting your time, but is it a service you guys offer where a young practice owner can reach out and say, hey, I'm just thinking ahead. I don't know if I can find in my area a dentist to come by my practice. Like, I want to know what do you think my practice is worth? What would you do if you were in my shoes to increase the value if I did want to go that route down the road? Will you guys work with young podcast listeners or other pediatric dentists?
Sure, absolutely.
What kind of documents you guys look for? Like clean financials, just send me a profit and loss or last year's taxes, and we can do some math over a phone call and kind of give you an estimate. What does that process look like?
You know, we typically go through a full valuation process for anybody who's going to have over $1.5 million in collections. And so we're going to look at 3 years of profit and loss statements, no tax returns, and we're going to ask some questions to figure out where the bodies are buried, add back the personal expenses, add back the non-recurring expenses. So we give a doctor a very specific EBITDA calculation and a very specific value estimate and the number of bidders I think that they'll have. For doctors who have less than $1.5 million in collections, take a look at our website, send me an email. I live on email 7 days a week and we'll have a conversation. And, you know, my theory is I learn something from every doctor I talk to.
Yeah, that's fair. Chip, that kind of worked my way through my list of questions, which is good because I think we're doing okay on time. But I was going to start wrapping up, maybe have you give some final thoughts if I missed anything or anything Pete specific. And then otherwise, if somebody wants to get in contact with you or your team just to kind of facilitate a conversation, maybe you can leave us with some contact info for you as well.
Absolutely. We'll start with contact info. It's Chip, like a potato chip, at largepracticesales.com. We'll get you directly to me. Our website is obviously largepracticesales.com. There's a lot of information on there and we'd love to have a conversation with you. I think pediatric practices today, due to their values, doctors deserve it to understand the value of their practice, to understand what an invisible DSO partnership really is. Because ultimately you're either going to join one or you're going to compete with many. The rapid consolidation has probably already come to your community. And keep in mind, because these are your silent partners, they're not announcing to the community that you have a new partner. They're not changing your brand name. They're not telling you who to hire or who to fire. It's a very autonomous relationship, but you can access some real resources to reduce your administrative burdens. I bet the majority of our $150 million worth of doctors under 30 did the invisible DSO partnership to offload administrative burdens to be able to spend more time with their young families.
Makes sense. Chip, I think that's all I got. I appreciate you carving out some time on a Monday to come chat with me and talk some shop. Listeners, are you going to be, do you guys come to, let's see, AAPD is coming up in probably a month. Or 2 months. Are you guys going to be out there?
We will be. It's Toronto this year.
Toronto. Yes, sir.
Yes, sir.
Okay. So people can find you there. That sounds good.
Absolutely.
Awesome. Well, Chip, appreciate your time and have a great day and we will stay in touch. All right.
Fantastic. Thank you, doctor. I appreciate your time.
Absolutely. Have a good one. Thank you.
You too.
Thanks for listening to the Bruise and Tiny Teeth podcast. Be sure to DM our host, Casey Getz, on social media with any listener questions, comments, or tough clinical situations. We'll see you next week for another unfiltered episode.